But if I had property and I was the only person in it, I'd probably hold it 10, 15, 20 years. But then you need to make sure you have money to do capital again after, you know, 5, 10 years, you have to recapitalize the property because now you need to redo stuff, right? So that's the other disadvantage. You know, you don't want to hold property too long and be like, oh, now we redid it. 5 years later, we have to redo it again. We don't have the money. So you do a refi, maybe pull money out, or you just sell it. I'm not saying selling the bad thing by any means, but we're selling more this year than we definitely planned on selling, for sure.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Mark Kenny with Think Multifamily. Welcome to the show.
Sam, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great, sir. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. Mark, there's three questions I ask every single person who comes on this show. If you don't mind quickly telling us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
I started with smaller multifamily. So it was 28 years ago, my identical twin brother, senior in college. Did corporate world for a while and then started doing syndications back in looking 2013. Done about over 13,000 units since then in 12 states. Got there really through a lot of pain. I had a partner that I partnered up with that had more experience than me that helped get a larger multifamily property. But earlier on, it was just my brother and myself doing small properties. He had no idea what we were doing. We just thought real estate was a good idea. So we started investing together ourselves, but we didn't know what we were doing at all. And we self-managed, which was painful as well.
There's a lot more to this story if we really dig in on this. 28 years ago, small multifamily, you're in college and you're buying property. And then you're like, hey, I'm going to go join the corporate world. Why did you do that if you were already buying real estate?
We're buying small properties. I mean, kind of grew up kind of your typical, hey, go to school, go to college, get a job. And we grew up with not a lot of extras. So my brother and I were like, we want to be able to give more to our kids and stuff like that. Even though we were young, we were thinking that far ahead. We didn't have enough money to go out and buy a bunch of properties. You know, we'd buy a property, another 1 or 2 years, buy another property. So there's no way we could have lived off the income we were making, unfortunately, with those smaller properties. And we kind of just did what we were taught. Go to school, became CPA for a while, did IT consulting, started an IT company, but continued to buy small properties. And even after buying more and more small properties, still couldn't replace my income. So we started buying larger properties.
Gotcha. That's interesting. One of the things you said there in the beginning, when I asked, how'd you get there? And you chuckled and said a lot of pain. What comes to mind when you say that?
Well, earlier on, my brother and I, we both worked kind of big four consulting and we worked a lot of hours, traveled a lot, but we ended up doing everything ourselves. We self-managed. We would try to fix sheetrock, and we have like an 8-hour toilet story that took us about 8 hours because we had to do it 3 or 4 times because we kept cracking it and stuff like that. But shoveling snow in the middle of winter in Michigan, it really wasn't a pleasant experience. It wasn't. But we were willing to kind of like go through it because we were like, this is all we knew. We didn't know anything about syndication, raising money from other people. No way we could have went and bought 100 unit property at that time based on what we knew, people we knew. So we were just doing, you know, small little properties every couple of years, get another property. And it just wasn't one big event at a duplex, you know, heater goes out, HVAC or whatever. There's your profit for the year, basically, you know, it wasn't ideal.
When did you decide to scale?
2013. I had an IT business. I started 2008, pretty decent overall. At least I thought I was, but I was working really like 90 hours a week, every week. Consistently, not during, you know, I never had a project, never not had a project for 20 years of consulting. I was on a project every single day during that time. Didn't spend much time with my wife, Tamil. She had a problem with that for some reason. And she's like, hey, this is not working out. You need to do something different. And I'm like, well, we both like real estate because we got married young and we were buying properties together. My wife and I were too when we got married. I said, well, we need to buy larger properties if we're going to try to replace even partial of my IT income. Our goal initially was not to replace all my IT income because we could still live pretty decent if I was making maybe half of what I was making. That was the goal was, hey, too busy, not enough time for family, probably stressed 1 to 10. My stress level was definitely a 10 on a daily basis. It wasn't a very good environment and health-wise and things like that. It just wasn't good.
Were you able to sell that IT company before you guys launched into multi?
Yeah, no, it was really more of a project base. So we did mostly projects. And frankly, I kind of just started doing less and less, which was good. I could scale it down. We actually still have one customer left from 4 years ago. We built a product for them on top of a software and they keep renewing. So I don't do anything with it. But no, I really didn't want anything to do with the business anymore. And it really wasn't, when I got out of it, it really wasn't that valuable. I had a number of Fortune 100 customers, but those are all just project-based work.
How did you make the selection to get into multifamily? What were your next steps and kind of thinking your way through that? I mean, getting into multifamily is one thing, syndicating is another thing, launching a thought leadership platform and then bringing other investors on and teaching them how to do it. I mean, I'm sure this was an iterative process, but kind of walk us through that if you can.
Yeah, I mean, kind of looked at a lot of different avenues when kind of had this, you know, issue with my time and looked at some franchises, looked at some other like custom home development. And everything's just another job. A friend of mine actually was doing a syndication in 2013 and I invested passively in his deal. And I was like, this kind of makes a lot of sense. Can go bigger and could eventually get to where you could replace your income and have it as a job. He was doing it full time. So that's kind of how I got started. I invested in several deals that first year as passive because I had, you know, IRA funds and SEP 401ks and things like that. Pretty decent with numbers, CPA and things like that. I'm like, this makes complete sense. It's not that difficult to figure out how to analyze deals and things like that. It wasn't for me. I picked it up pretty quickly, I guess. But there were a lot of other steps involved. As you mentioned, the capital raising side, I was really extremely nervous about trying to ask people if you want to stay for money, even though people say, oh, no, you're presenting an opportunity to them. Like, well, it feels like I'm asking for money. I don't want to ask people for money, right? Because it just doesn't come across. I didn't like it. I didn't ask my parents for money growing up. I didn't want to ask other people, but it was more of a mindset. I was like, man, I didn't know about syndication and the tax benefits. I had an IT business paying all kinds of taxes and started doing multifamily full-time real estate professional, haven't paid taxes since 2018 for federal income tax. So when I started learning some of the tax benefits, things like that too, I'm like, this actually has a lot of merit to it. And it's something I love doing. But we went through a lot during that process. It took us almost a year to get our first deal just because we were distracted looking at other things. And Dallas seemed to get kind of expensive. Started looking outside Dallas, went to Atlanta next. Now we're in, you know, 12 states. But it's iterative. I think people look at it sometimes and go, well, okay, you went from A to whatever. And it did pretty quickly. But everyone kind of starts out. We have a consultant or a coaching group. And people are like, oh, I want to go do a $50 million deal, my first deal. It's like, okay, not saying it's not possible, but you know, probably gonna take baby steps. And initially you're probably not gonna make a lot and not as much, right? Because you're only doing a small piece of a deal. But eventually, after you start getting more and more involved in it and learn more and more, you get bigger and bigger pieces of the deal. And then you can, if you wanna, you know, say retire, whatever that means to somebody, you can do that maybe. Biggest thing for me is I don't have to ask anybody to do anything other than my wife, really. If I don't wanna work anymore, frankly, I don't really have to. I used to think when I was younger, hey, I'd go sit on the beach for my life. Well, I don't really want to do that either. Not for an extended period of time.
You mentioned that you were extremely nervous going to ask investors for money. And there's a mindset shift there. Even if there's a mindset shift, how did you find the investors? How did you begin those conversations? Just kind of give us the snowball of that.
Yeah, for sure. We were attending a lot of events, like meetups and different events that were going on. There weren't nearly as many events back then as there are now, but we were attending a lot of them. And I think from IT perspective, I was pretty successful. A lot of people I worked with, in a lot of cases, both spouses worked, so they had pretty good income. I had been buying smaller multifamily, so it wasn't like I was brand new to it. And then with the people did like the aspect that I had a, you know, pretty strong financial background looking at deals, because you're really looking at a business when you buy, you know, a little bit larger multifamily. I kind of just started talking to people about it. And then when I learned about some of the tax benefits better, that was a big opening for people because a lot of people make pretty decent money. They pay a lot in taxes. When I have my IT business, I used to ask my CPA, and he's like, I'm like, how can I stop paying so much in taxes? Like, you really can't. You just keep doing what you're doing and pay all these taxes. I'm like, I know a lot of rich people that don't pay taxes, right? I don't know them a lot. I hear about them, I should say. So I'm like, I don't want to pay taxes. But it was really, as you kind of meet people face to face at events, it was very helpful. I think if you can relate to somebody, forget business wise, but relate to somebody on some sort of personal level, whether it's kids or whether it's some sort of hobby you have, some people think that's a waste of time at events. It's not. You're going to connect with people better, in my opinion, on a personal level first. They need to know you a little bit, like you. I don't want to do business people I don't like. I don't. And you're not going to connect with everybody. But if you can get yourself out there, make an effort to go to events, it's a time suck sometimes, right? It might be your whole weekend. Plus, maybe you're traveling somewhere. But if you make an effort to meet people while you were there, and number one is follow up with them afterwards. I mean, if you just do that one thing, get business cards, people have them, or get their contact information, follow up with them within, you know, I used to always do it within 24 hours. I'd follow up with everybody I met at an event. And I know from other people that I talk to, most people don't do that. They put a business cards on their table, you know, and they just leave them there. Don't follow up. So that one thing by itself, then jump on a call with them, build that relationship further, and then see.
It was 2013, and you guys are getting some capital lined up. You are trying to find deals. Like, what was the next stage in your business?
Yeah, we were very active in the market. So we looked at deals all the time, analyzed deals on a regular basis, met with the brokers. Dallas, fortunately, was a good market because there were so many deals being sold. And then we looked at most of them being sold in the market. And we were able to do a few deals pretty quickly, 64 doors, 208 doors, and 255 doors relatively quickly. And then we started expanding out of Dallas too into Atlanta at a pretty good time, 2016. A lot less competition there at the time. So we were pretty successful buying a number of deals there and started going to other states. And then we do have a kind of a coaching mentoring program. So a number of people in the group, they're able to leverage our contacts with brokers and things like that. And so they're actively looking at deals. So the deal flow is pretty high. And a lot of the brokers we do business with, we are pretty high on their priority list because we've done a lot of deals with them. So they'll bring us deals on a pretty regular basis that are maybe not marketed to other people.
Talk to us about the iterations. It's one thing to go out and buy 500 doors. But then it's another thing to say, all right, we're going to build a coaching program.
It's probably not for a lot of people, to be frank. It was something that my wife, Tamil, and I had no intentions of doing. Through some circumstances, people were kind of coming to us a little bit, asking us to help them in certain areas. And we kind of got into the point where, hey, we'll do webinars, we'll do a meetup, we'll do a one-day event, and started doing events and things like that. And kind of just fell in love with the aspect of people that are out there that maybe, whatever, similar to what we were going through, if we can help them, there are a lot of things that I was never taught, unfortunately, even though we had a mentor. I wish we would have been taught more things that I'm like, man, why didn't we know this or this or that? Now we've done, you know, over 80 transactions. So I'm like, I can share quite a bit of what I've gone through. And it's not easy for people act like it's easy. It's not. Well, you're going to be frustrated. You're going to hit hurdles and things like that. It was not planned from the beginning, if you want to say. It was very gradual, just a little bit education, a little bit more, and then to the point where we're like, hey, we really like this. And then we're able to help people kind of either quit their job or the spouse quits their job, save money in taxes. And now that whole aspect of the coaching is, it is a family type vibe. We do vacations together and things like that, hang out with a bunch of people from our group on a weekly basis. It was kind of the best of both worlds. I like the transaction side and the technical side. And then my wife was very much more into the culture and the community, kind of married those two together. And now we have our group called the Family Syndication Group, purpose because we have a family atmosphere and people work together, try not to compete against each other and help everyone get into deals if they choose to.
What are some of the things when you say that you had a mentor and that even then some things were left on the table? What were some of those gaps that you aimed to fill?
I mean, one of the biggest ones, frankly, was just he didn't want to give me rules of thumb for anything, which I thought was kind of odd. I know they're just rules of thumb, right? But you need to have some sort of perspective when you're first starting out, you know, because I was doing small properties. Other things like having capital set aside, right, for contingencies and working capital and all the things you run into with a lender. We've had lenders sometimes hold money for 5-6 months before they reimburse us. I mean, you need to have that money up front to do that. And then what do you look for on, you know, things for income growth and having rents that just go from $800 to $900 overnight. It's a gradual type thing, right? And you have to figure out how many units are going to be rehabbed in a given month. And you're going to have to increase that rent over like a 2-year period. So in my mind, a lot of things that I would consider very basic now really weren't taught. And these are things where one mistake can be, you know, you're not talking tens of thousands of dollars, you're talking maybe hundreds of thousands and maybe even millions of dollars. It's the whole perspective type thing. You know, how much should your property be worth when you sell it 5 years from now? Well, I give some rules of thumb around that. I tell people, hey, just based on experience only, right? Don't necessarily use them as the end all be all, but to have no reference point at all, this is not useful.
As you rewind the tape, what are some things maybe that you would do differently in your journey?
The biggest thing probably for me would be having more money raised up front, which is what we do that now. The other thing was that we weren't taught anything about how to structure deals. There was one way to structure a deal, which I think is silly. There are many ways to structure a deal. There was really only one loan option, which I think is silly because it eliminates a lot of the deals that we bought deals before that are 26% occupied. Double your money in a year. Okay, you can't do that on a Fannie or Freddie loan. Now, you might choose not to do those deals. That's fine. But to not educate people on that, or raising capital where you can do 506B or 506C, you can advertise. Never taught that before. I'm like, this is like so basic. So we do our best to say expose people to every single aspect of the business. And you can pick and choose. You're an adult, right? And you're trying to build a business, what you want to do. But to not have exposure to all those things, I think you're doing a disservice to people that you're trying to coach or mentor.
When you say you wish you would have raised more money up front, what are some experiences that come to mind that you say, man, that would have been really helpful if we'd done that on this particular project? Yeah,
the number one downfall to not have enough money up front is when you have contractors that have to get started and they want to be paid up front, at least some sort of percentage. And then you have to usually pay them first and then submit it to the lender. And the lender sits on their hands for weeks or months at a time, no joke, back and forth. Oh, I have a question on this. What is that? Before you know it, you know, 3 months later, you're waiting for, you know, $400,000 to come in that you had to pay out. Then what do? Do you stop work? Because the vendors aren't going to necessarily work for free. And if you don't pay them, they're going to be like, hey, you're on my list now. I'm not going to actually come back to your property until you pay me. That's probably the number one thing that a lot of people miss. It's a pretty basic thing, frankly. And you think, well, how would you just know that? Well, I didn't know the way draws worked with a lender. Mentor never told me that. I didn't know that you might wait months to get reimbursed by a lender. Never told me that. Working capital was basically not even discussed, and contingency wasn't really discussed. So this is some basic things in my mind that anybody new starting out should know. There's no reason to go through these headaches and mistakes that people make, because reality is we've made mistakes. We can make a lot less mistakes now and find them a lot faster and fix them a lot faster. That's the whole goal, right?
You said you're now at over 13,000 units. Is that right?
We've done over 13,000. We have about 10,000, a little over 10,000 right now. We've sold some, selling probably too many this year, more than I want. But right, when you do a syndication, you know, I would just tell people that, hey, look at the projections, and people will say, well, hey, you've been returning X percent on the other deals. I'm like, well, just assume that's not going to be the case, right? Because everyone's been a little spoiled, including us, right? And market's cooperating. We have a deal, two deals right now. One we bought November last year, or last year in December, and we have offers on them where we'll hit our 5-year projection. This through some circumstances, and it's pretty hard to go to investors and say, well, we don't think we should, you know, necessarily sell. Now, we could do a refinance. There's some things around that. So every individual deal you want to look at, whether you should sell it, refinance, do a supplemental loan. But some of the offers we're getting, frankly, it makes sense to sell. It just does. And it's pretty hard to argue, you know, 1 to 2 years, you can meet your 5-6 year projection. Now, what do you do with the money? Now you have to go buy another deal that is just the same price as the deal you sold, right? So I get that. And with a refi, you can get some tax-free and things like that. But I just say too many because I want to keep the streak of not having to pay any taxes. Well, you know, you get recapture. We're looking at maybe even doing 1031, even though it's syndication and stuff like that. But we have more deals this year we're getting offers on that are just, I mean, quite frankly, ridiculous offers and pretty hard to turn down. But if I had property and I was the only person in it, I'd probably hold it 10, 15, 20 years. But then you need to make sure you have money to do capital again after, you know, 5, 10 years, you have to do recapitalize the property because now you need to redo stuff, right? So that's the other disadvantage. You know, you don't want to hold property too long and be like, oh, now we redid it. 5 years later, we have to redo it again. We don't have the money. So you do a refi, maybe pull money out, or you just sell it. I'm not saying selling the bad thing by any means, but we're selling more this year than we definitely planned on selling for sure.
There's lots of different schools of thought around that. And like you said, you know, holding the capital or recapitalizing the project in 10 years, because now it's time for remodels again.
Right.
Right. If you're going to stay competitive in the marketplace, you can't have something that's 10, 20 years old.
We'll do about 20 deals this year too. So we're still buying a lot of deals.
That's almost 2 deals a month. So it's not like you're standing on your thumbs. What are you guys doing right now that you, speaking of a really hot market, what are you doing right now that you feel like is allowing you still to find opportunity?
It's really from the several years of building up relationships with the brokers. So most of the deals we get in these markets, a lot of cases, we're not the only group typically. There might be 4 or 5 other groups, but a handful of groups that are going after deals versus 100+ people looking at deals. So just building those relationships with brokers, letting them sell properties. You know, a lot of properties are selling in Atlanta. We use primarily one broker for that. We bought, I don't know, maybe 14 deals with these guys in a few years, but we let them sell the properties too. So that's something you want to do, provided they're competitive, which they are, and they're great to work with. So if you can just be good buyer, good seller, do what you say you're going to do, then you can be in the business a long time. If you're going to be short-sighted, hard to work with, people think you're rude and things like that, you might still get stuff done, but people don't want to work with you.
Mark, this has been great. Thank you for your time today and coming on. Let's launch into a final few questions here for you. First one is this, and you may have answered this already, but we'll give you another crack at it, which is, if you could help a listener avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
For me, it's really been raise more capital. It's pretty easy to avoid it if you can raise the capital and knowing how much extra you need to raise. You can't be ridiculous about it because it impacts your returns, but that's probably the one thing that's given me the most heartburn on earlier deals, not raise enough capital.
Is there a budget? Is there a cushion? You say, all right, we need X number of dollars to get this deal done. Here's what we need for, like, is there like that plus 10% that you always say, or what's your metric on that?
We always do, for working capital, we always do 1 full month of potential gross rent. So it's like 8.33% for that. And then the contingency will vary a lot on whether we're getting the lender provided funds for CapEx or we're raising the money. If lender's going to provide it, we usually do more. We usually start at 10%, but if you're doing a bigger deal, you don't necessarily need 10%. But it's going to depend on your CapEx project. So it can vary widely for that, but it needs to be more than zero for sure.
So your rule of thumb there is that you're going to use 10% over for the CapEx budget. So if it's $1 million, you're going to raise 1.1 million for the CapEx. Is that right? Am I following?
Well, the 10% default is, and it can be lower than that, right? Is actually on the raise. So going over 10% of the raise. Yeah.
Hey, that's really helpful. If that's a lesson that you've learned the hard way and that's what you do now, I think listeners will find that very valuable because those are tangible action steps that we can take. Mark, when it comes to investing in the world, what is one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Giving back to other people less fortunate. So we're very much into the kind of orphanages, things like that, and the sex traffic industry are the two areas that we're most focused on as far as giving back.
Mark, if our listeners want to get in touch with you,
best way to get a hold would be my email. It's Mark, M-A-R-K, at thinkmultifamily.com.
Mark, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it. This was great.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.